Yeah, hi. My name is Anna-Kaisa Kultima, as Ilkka introduced me, and I'm a game researcher at the University of Tampere. For the past 7 years or so, or maybe even more, I've been looking into games phenomena, industry, game makers, from different perspectives. And not really that much on the business models as maybe some of the focus of this lecture is, but from the everyday life of game developers and different cultural phenomena as well. Ilkka gave me kind of a free hand to talk what I want to, and so this talk will be kind of what I wanted to talk, hopefully. You can send me email or follow me on Twitter. I have two accounts. The other one is just basic. When I go to conferences, when I see something interesting, I tweet about it. And the other one tries to be an account that would be more or less a note to myself of what I play. And some parts of my lecture will be about different things in games cultures and different things in games and a kind of a broader spectrum of play. So you might find maybe also toys on that Twitter account. And this time of the year is the worst time to make lectures, so please bear with me if I go a little bit absent-minded. We have less than a week for the Global Game Jam, and that's going to be a blast again this year. So I'm also a president of Finnish Game Jam organization and trying to cover and support the game jamming culture in Finland and also globally. So I'm a game researcher at the University of Tampere at Information School of Information Sciences. I always have to kind of look and cheat on that because the department name has been changing so oftenly for the past 5 years. But I'm with the information scientists and with a group of game researchers working at the university. So what the researcher usually does, we do studies. We might write things and publish perhaps books or articles. And then I also teach at the university. And I teach game design and design research and perhaps a little bit about game research as well. But more importantly for myself, maybe to give you a little bit more context on what I'm today talking and what parts of my talk you should be more critical of or what parts you should believe of. I'm from Lapland originally. I'm from Sodankylä, and my kind of dear home is a research center. And there is me on the place that I was born, and there is this huge antenna. So I was part of a kind of a natural science environment when I grew up. And that might be a reason for me to be a researcher, but that's also a reason for me to be with technology, because I saw computers to develop from huge cabins to tiny tiny things that we carry now all the time. I originally graduated from University of Turku, and I studied theoretical philosophy, which has nothing to do with anything, and then everything to do with everything. So it doesn't really give you that much of practical, tangible things to go with your life. But it was something of a passion for me. And it might explain some of the things that I am researching now as well. But the first workplace that I worked at was at the University of Lapland. I've been going back and forth, like many, many Finns do, because we have to go where the things are and the country is long. So I was at the University of Lapland on the Media Pedagogy Center, and we looked at the educational games and playful learning environments. I was involved in a project called Let's Play. And as I said, I'm heavily involved with Global Game Jam and Game Jam community. From the 2010, we've had locations in Finland participating this event. How many of you know what Global Game Jam is? How many of you have participated on Global Game Jam? How many of you have participated on any game jam? Okay, that's too little, way too little. You've got to start participating. But anyway, my practically only experience on making games is perhaps still on something that you could play. It's a sauna arpa. I was part of developing this internet scratch ticket thing. It was fun. So I kind of don't know myself how game making is, but I've been doing a lot of stuff involved with that and talking to several game developers. I've been used to kind of a fact that, for instance, in the Nordic countries, a lot of people know what game researchers are. But then my first trip ever to more of a Russian area of game development was last year, around 1 year ago. And there was this one person after the presentation coming and asking, like, I don't understand, what is this thing called game researcher? And the reason why I want to tell you that is that there is a kind of a gap between game development and research, and there are good reasons for that, and then there are also bad reasons for that. And I suggest you that you try to at least talk to some game researchers to involve on kind of closing the gap. But to tell you a little bit more about what else there is as a game researcher's field, here's something about our game research lab. Here are my colleagues, Heikki, Kati, and Timo, with cool glasses, 3D glasses anyway. And then Olli, Sotama, and what we do kind of different things, everybody. So we have different backgrounds, like mine is in philosophy, and Timo's background is in computer science, as well as Kati's, and then Heikki's background is in media studies. And our professor, Franz Maurer, he did his thesis on literature studies. And then Olli had a culture studies background. And then we also have sociologists and what else? I fear that I forget someone's background. But we do different kinds of things from different backgrounds. And so some of us might look at the play experience and the player's perspective. So for instance, we have this yearly player barometer of Finnish gamers or Finnish players or Finnish playing habits. We want to know what actually people do and how much do they play, how much time do they consume with games. And then we also have studies that are for money gaming, gambling. For instance, my colleague Jani Kinnunen has done a lot of work on that. Two of my colleagues, Markus and Jaakko, has done a groundwork on covering the theoretical aspects of LARP and role-playing phenomena. And then we also have a game business side. We do a lot of research on the trends. For instance, in 2009, we started a project that looked into the mobile games. Oh, no, 2006, sorry. And 2009 with social games. And now we have a research project on free-to-play models. But a lot of the Nordic scene is to do with more of a culture studies. We do have a lot of other fields as well, and it's very multidisciplinary, but heavily influenced with the culture study people. But nevertheless, so anything that you can imagine or that could be studied, there might be someone looking into it. So we have a huge community of game researchers looking at different aspects, but also there's a lot of researchers that utilize games for their kind of research purposes. For instance, they want to know something about cognitive load or ethical aspects or anything like that, and they don't necessarily communicate with the rest of the game researchers, but with their kind of base field. What I've done from the year 2006 when I moved from University of Lapland to University of Tampere and started to do with research on a project called Game Space. We looked into design methods and kind of design principles of casual mobile multiplayer games, which was the thing at the moment. So I've done this. This might be something that maybe you have tried or you've heard about. It's kind of a brainstorming game that we developed in that project, and I've tried to develop that further to look into the ways that we could kind of help brainstorming sessions that is to do with game ideation. So that's one of the things that I've done quite heavily, and especially in the beginning of my studies. I've also done quite many interview studies. For instance, the way asking game developers how do they ideate, and I promise ideate is an actual word. So it's not a Finglishim, it's actual word. So ideation is the word. So I interviewed around 23 people from different companies, and how do they come up with new ideas. This was my first interview study. And the result is that the methods and the practices vary. So it's not at all shared or kind of set ways. So people have their own ways. Some might kind of see their whole practice of brainstorming so that when they step into a room, they see everything around them as an inspiration for games. So like, what if that a table there would be a game with the fictional characters or something like that? So they take everything as an inspiration for their creative practice. Some people might have more of a kind of a trust on epiphany or anything like that, so that there is nothing specific method or technique, so you have nothing, and then the ideas just come up. Some people might treat the creative process as a black box, and some of them might be more educated as how for instance, people in creative research field are looking into what do they believe that the creativity is about. So the training and the practice varies a lot with game developers, so it's not really that solid. I do believe that now that we have more educational kind of tracks for games, that might change a little bit. But to be honest, I'm not that trusting on that because as I've been looking into this stuff, we don't actually know that much yet that it would be formalized easily to the educational track. But maybe, perhaps in the future. And there's a lot of also kind of negative views on formalizing creative practice in any way, anyways. But one interesting thing, at least, is that the practice of making game ideas in actual productions is more of a solitude process. So even though, for instance, creativity researchers are looking more and more into collaborative practices, the everyday life of a game developer is so that you might be the only one that can actually brainstorm and that on that particular thing because other people are busy. But anyway... I hope you ask questions in between if there's anything, but maybe later. So I did get a positive feedback on looking into those creativity techniques and formal methods, brainstorming games and such things from our funders of the project. We got a lot of positive feedback also from the developers. And I had a speech on GDC on 2008, and I had a huge line of people asking questions because it does wonder people like how can we do this in a better way? How can we actually help the processes in the companies? But then again, I also had a very bad feedback, and unfortunately, obviously, a lot of those were not said in direct for me. And this was a result of a party that continued all the way to the 9 a.m. And I got a direct feedback from one Finnish game developer say an exact sentence in Finnish, which was very, it didn't offend me at all. It was very, very good point of my research. Yeah, there.
I'm just curious, was it an independent developer or was it a developer associated with the company?
I will not reveal any names.
I'm not asking for a name. Yeah.
It is a professional game developer with a lot of experience as well. So I'm going to walk you through with this sentence. This is one of the sentences that is a slightly kind of a turning point in my research. Every kind of researcher, which is a good researcher or should be a good researcher, knows that their research is shit. So this is part of the reality of the academic person in general. You should be aware of the lackings of your research, and it's always based on some kind of a artificial constraint or artificial things around it, or theoretical assumptions, or academic tradition, or anything like that. So working in between game kind of industry and research is hard in this sense, that you kind of want to do research which makes sense for the developers and would help developers as well. And then you want to do research that would give back to the academic community. And one part of the research which is brainstorming for me is something to give back to the academic field, because there's a lot of study on brainstorming and people are very interesting and very tiny, minuscule things in that process, cognitive process, how it works, how what affects to what, and so on. But then again, if you look at the practice of, for instance, game making, some of those minuscule details makes no sense at all. So that's completely unrelevant for your daily practice if you have a lot of steps before that step. So this was a kind of a turning point for me, that it's very important for me to look also what's happening around it. Not only the brainstorming, not only the how people make ideas and how people maybe go forward with the ideas and the importance of the ideas in general. And also the fact that there isn't enough understanding that I could use as a context for myself when I'm looking into game ideation processes. So it's only for from the academic point of view, but from the games point of view, there's very little. So actually what I'm trying to do is that I always say, if people ask me that, what do you study for? I always say that I am doing my PhD on the creative process of game developers. And it's a very, very wide topic, but that's the easiest way to explain. What a lot of people kind of suggest me, that have you looked into that or that or that designer's work? Or have you followed the indie scene? Is that there's a lot of interesting creativity things in there. But what I'm actually interested of is the average Joe of game development team, or those people that do their stuff on daily basis, and how creativity is involved. I should hold it this way so that I don't mute the microphone. Anyway, so I'm interested in the everyday life of a game developer and the creativity within that. I'm still interested in tools and guides, so more of a normative side of research, so maybe I could have some suggestions for game makers, but that's very hard when you don't have a good understanding on how the field is actually working on. So I know that a lot of researchers are kind of taught to be more normative. So in order for you to be respectful academic, you should be able to rise above and say, you're doing it wrong and this is the way you should be doing it. So that means the normative side of the research. So give suggestions and maybe collect best practices, which is very popular in some sides of the game research. But to be more humble and to say that we don't know enough of the practice itself, to be able to say that you should do it this way or that way. But I do have some provocative thoughts of myself. I don't know if I can share them today, as Ilkka kind of asked me, but we'll see if I'm able to say anything like that. But then again, also to look at the creative ecosystem of game making, because the current focus is more or less on the core of the industry, like Holy Trinity of game making, game designers, game programmers, and game artists, and how they work, or what kind of stuff they would do. Or in the sense that, okay, there's other people as well. There's community management. There's the creative lead. There's other positions that we now find more interesting, and the industry is maturing in that way. But what I mean with ecosystem is that we also have different kinds of companies. We have also indies versus the AAA productions. We have different cultural traditions for game making and so on, and also maybe people that would be called as game experts that could be working in the ministries or could be working on, I don't know, libraries and so on. So I do believe that this kind of field is much more wider than just the core kind of developmental side. You had a question?
Yeah, just thinking about if you could exchange a few words about ecosystems around games and game development, because I'm doing my thesis about such matters.
Okay, there's a lot of different ways, different stuff that it could mean. But what I mean is the kind of ecosystem of people, the different kinds of professionals to do with games. So obviously game journalists, publishers, funders, whatever kind of people that are involved with the whole industry, and also beyond the industry itself, like teachers and so on. But there's obviously other stuff that the ecosystem could mean, right? We can talk also later if you want. Was there another question?
Yeah, I just asked if you could have repeated the question.
So he was asking, like, could I elaborate the ecosystem of games? Pretty much like that. Okay, I try to remember that. So to give you this is one thing that I want you to understand, that when there is a research on how games are made, how the design process works, how the development is working, there is almost non-existence in the field of research on that sense within games. So we don't know, within the academic field of knowledge, we don't know anything about game making. This slide is for kind of, there's this some design researchers that have done history on design research, which usually refers to industrial design and architecture. And why I put it here is to show you that kind of a design research, which is the thing that I'm doing, history in general is already very young. And what they say, that they had these phases, that there's senior designers and kind of their writings about the process has been the early phases of design research up until to the 50s. And then maybe the intellectual kind of people trying to form methodologies or structural thinking on how design is done. To the 90s and so, more of an actual empirical data collection. But what I'm kind of argumenting is that we're not even past the first phase with the game design research. So what probably... okay, raise your hand if you have seen any of these books on this list. Okay, these are kind of classical books that you might read from the game development. And many of those are written by the game developers themselves. And usually by one person, so it's kind of a... Maybe they've had already 15 years of experience and they are putting their experience in words. And some of them were released in the early 2000s, so 2003 to 2006 or something. And already... some of the stuff is old, but also you have to keep in mind that they're also view of a one person, and they sometimes do elaborate their experience and the background But sometimes they don't do that so specifically, like what kind of productions they've made. And for the past 4 or 5 years, we've had so much change within game productions and game products that not all of those things are still valid. For instance, if we're talking about games as services and not boxed products anymore, even though we do have also that side. But anyway, so the thing is that we have information, and where you can seek it from is not from the academic domain, but from professionals like Ilkka has collected to this lecture, that you have people telling about their experiences. But then again, it is only one person that is talking about their experience. And the problem with expertise or the knowledge of the design experts is that people are used to rationalize, for instance, the processes. So they tell about what kind of way it is expected to tell. So this is a common problem in design research. How do we understand? How can we search? How can we really understand what is happening in game productions and how or design productions when people, for instance, are used to client discussions and talk about, oh, I really planned it this way, even though it might be just a kind of a organic trait from first point to the last point, and a lot of iteration in between, also another design practice than game design. But anyway, so perhaps not making that so clear, but wanted to tell you that this is the only way for you to get the information in one way, but also you have to be very active for yourself to search for information. You have to be the one that is kind of addicted to learning, because that's where the whole game industry is built on. So when there is a person that is able to explicate their understanding of the process or models or whatever, that's already kind of old news, because we are going forward with those things with the game industry. I invite you to be kind of to argue with that. But anyway, also one other thing, which is because most of you or all of us have gone through a formal educational system called school, and we're kind of taught to weigh what is the kind of right way to seek knowledge, and the knowledge which is kind of based on the knowledge that you use for making new products, making new services, or making design is a different kind of knowledge than what you were taught in a history class or math class and so on. So, because I do believe and I hope that you're here on this lecture to be educated for the industry itself, right? So you are seeking this knowledge for you to make games or you to be involved in the games business. And maybe you want to learn it like somebody taking your hand and guiding through the process, but you have to be kind of an active agent in your own learning path. You have to find different ways to learn it. Maybe have discussions with Ilkka or Samuli or whoever who's been experienced in this. Have parallel discussions, ask same questions from different people, because they will give you different answers. Read from different sources and so on. So it's not that we are teaching you math, because we kind of we made a contract with math, so it is definitive that this leads to that. But when we're teaching things that has to do with design, or we're teaching things that has to do with game design or business, one thing might not lead to another, even though it did do that in the other case. So how do you know? This is a similar problem for my own research than for your research, which is for your industry practice. I hope I'm not making this too complicated, because it's not really that that complicated thing. But forget how you learned in your previous life, and I just have to learn for your craft. So how do we learn? Nowadays we say with games that we do learn with metrics. And then the traditional way is to learn with lectures, not only school things, but perhaps going to conferences and learn from other people. And one very popular complaint by game industry people on the game conferences is that lecture was full of bullshit. Because people do expect still that somebody would tell them how, for instance, game metrics should work, or how they should work with their game engine, or how they should work with their graphics and so on. And if you go for lectures that you already kind of are somewhat experienced on those topics, you might be disappointed. But if you go for conferences and go for lectures that you haven't heard about those things, that's kind of a level that people can provide. Even though game industry is very, very into sharing their expertise and knowledge, it is not too often that you get something completely new from the lectures. But then again, it's your job to go and ask additional questions, the things that you're interested of, and also look around what you're doing and do different kinds of experiments and go forward with your craft and be open-minded and so on. Yes. I hope Ilkka has a lecture for you for that.
Repeat the question.
Okay, so what do I mean by metrics? Do I mean that you somehow measure
the games?
And yes, that's what I mean. And that's the basis of free-to-play business on the current state. I hope you have a lecture for that. So that's a kind of... It didn't used to be like that because the games were not connected, so you couldn't really track gamers' activities while they play, so what kind of buttons they clicked and so on. But nowadays, the business is very much based on the fact that you know what people do and when do they drop out and so on. And there's other people that know more about that. That's one part, yeah. Okay, quite a long comment, but kind of baseline was that there's an ecosystem of things around the player, and you can do a lot of things, kind of also exploit the understanding of that, right?
Yeah.
Yes, to go with to another directions with the game design and so on, right?
Yeah.
Okay. yeah, so back to the slide. The next thing is something that I looked into from 2006 and 2009, more or less. And this is a kind of a slogan that a lot of game developers might say. It is a slogan that might be slightly kind of set with a pride. This is also a slogan for a lot of the design field elsewhere than games as well. User-centered design and taking the user in account and understanding your customers in order to know what you're designing for. And it used to be kind of very much of a slogan for a lot of people, but then there's also other side that has been rising from kind of from the game industry. So some people still would say, and kind of in a new way would say, that they make games for themselves. But some might be more into that other direction of being professional in a sense that you do games for a certain target group or certain kind of people, and you need to know what are their environments and what they're doing. And that is important, obviously. There's a lot of study on that and how we could do it better. But that's not the only way, and that's not the only picture. Do you want to say your comment on this?
Wait.
Okay, so the question is that this is a good question. So is there a research that would show that is there a correlation between this, do I make games for myself or do I make games for others? Is there a correlation between this and success? And I would say, first of all, that there isn't such study. Maybe there is, but I haven't heard about it. And then again, I would say that if there would be such study, it wouldn't teach us that much. Because I think that we are starting to understand that games is not one thing, but games are many things, and game industry is with different segments, different kinds of practices, and different kind of roads for success and different ways to do your thing in a good way. So first of all, the complicated thing would be to say that what is the success? For instance, for an indie game, is it the money success? Is it the commercial success? Or is it the critically acclaimed thing? Is it something that is highly popular even though it's not giving you any money? Is it successful because you were able to do some kind of a design challenge that was highly difficult? So, and then again, if, or do we mean it by that it is giving you shitloads of money? So that is a commercial success in a sense. So I wouldn't say that there could be any kind of a direct link between this. But there is a kind of rising two schools of thought. The other one is saying that the passion is ever more important. And this kind of I methodology of making games that you are using yourself as a base for your design process instead of, for instance, colder way of using metrics. And we even have designers and companies in Finland that are utilizing these two different tracks. The others are doing games for themselves and making sure that this is something that would be excellent and fun for themselves as a gamers. And then we have companies that are more into looking at what ticks their particular target group and are very good at it. So I wouldn't say that there would even be possibility to have a straightforward answer with the research on that. But if we would make it more minuscule, maybe we could find a correlation. But one kind of a thing that I would want you to understand, that the role of a research in academic field and the role of a research in the design field is different. So in academic field, we're a lot of the kind of value for knowledge is that if it's definite and if you can really repeat the research and so on. And then on the design field, it's more of a what kind of tools did you have for your successful product. But it's not a straightforward in that sense. So it's more messy on the non-academic field. But it doesn't mean that you're just using your intuition to make things that are awesome. Anyway. Yeah. So the question is that there is a kind of a stereotype for engineering or engineers and then a stereotype for artists that could correlate with the whole thing that I do make games for myself or not. Was there a question actually? Sorry.
Well,
a side note, yeah. As a comment, yeah. So yeah, that there's maybe some truth in that maybe as we are with this industry, there's people with different backgrounds, and that also means people with different school of thought in general, like what is your practice and what are your values, and I'm actually coming back to that topic later. Okay? But anyway, so to understand how game industry works and how your design process as well works as a game designer or game developer in general, is that we have to face it that we have started from the fact that we are gamers. Not necessarily every single person is a gamer that they come to the game industry, but a huge amount, like huge amount of people, like the most of the people are first and foremost gamers. And this is where the expertise of an understanding of the games is based on. And what happens when people start working in game industry is that they might even lose the whole gameness from their life. So when you are so full of games, you have to play your own products all the time, you have to maybe play some games that you wouldn't play otherwise by yourself for your work, you are not the gamer anymore, and this is the way that you kind of lose the touch to the expertise that you used to have. And obviously it's not possible if you are starting as a teenager or maybe a student that can play games more than 8 hours straight. You can't do that when you're starting your job, that you're doing maybe even 12 hours days at work, and it is relating to games, and you're completely tired with games. But you would have to somehow replace that. Like, how do you actually, how do you retrieve the same amount of knowledge? How do you build your intuition into for instance, saying conventions in a certain genre and so on, because everything is still developing further. Similar thing happens to our consultants that used to be game developers. And they might have you lessons that used to be true because they were working on that particular field. But if they are not involved in the daily life of a game maker, they might not understand certain changes that has happened. And similar things for your own gamer background. If you don't follow the same things, you are not an expert of FPS anymore. You are not an expert of I don't know, match three games if you're not using all your life on researching on that. So as you are, as you have gone through a formal system of school, you have been taught these pieces of knowledge, and in the same process you have been taught to understand that these are called knowledge. But then again, everything that you do in your life is building a knowledge base for you. So every hobby that you have, you gain knowledge. And that is valuable in some senses. And if you're basing your work to your on top of your hobby and then lose the hobby itself totally, that is a different kind of thing that you're doing and different kind of knowledge that you now have. This is one thing that I've been interested to look into more detail, like what kind of gamers Finnish developers used to be, or what kind of gamers they are now, and what kind of gamers we have as students. Because even though we're not talking about the impact of the hobby itself, this is the one that builds your intuition for your decisions. And also builds your similarities and differences. So the shared base of games is something, for instance, if we are heavy gamers, we might share some games that we play, and what kind of things are the official pieces of the game history we might know about the history of Pac-Man and Tetris or whatever. And then we might discuss about such Finnish masterpieces like Max Payne or other, I don't know, console games and so on. But if the game designers or game developers' background is based on the same games and same kind of inspiration, even though it makes it easier for you to become one and discuss about things in the development. For instance, as there hasn't been game schools before, the whole jargon or the vocabulary is based on references. Like, you might be in a development meeting and you might be using, like, oh, it's like the menu in the new Tomb Raider, or it's the thing, and that the similar kind of way that you use weapons in Ratchet and Clank and so on. So those are the ways that we talk about game design, and it makes it easier, but it also might make it so that we have the same ideas because we are following the same games and we're interested in the same things. My own game background is sometimes a little bit different. Like, a lot of the females of my age, the game hobby started from my brother's games. And then one very intense period of my life, I was heavily involved with the Sims community. And so the history for, and then, for instance, this, I don't know how many, it's a crappy picture, but how many of you know this game? No, there's this creature that comes from an egg. It's called Creatures. It's an interesting game piece, which is like one of the most successful, or the earliest ones with a huge online community. And it is kind of a masterpiece, of the, one of the historical points on the, I don't know, AI games. But it's never mentioned in history books. And so there's a lot of pieces in the history of games that people might have their personal game history, which might give them different kinds of ideas in their creative process. But I wanted you to start thinking that, like, my students, oftentimes they say that they play games very widely, and when I start talking with them, they are kind of with the AAA titles and then some indie games, and that's called wide. And they don't necessarily, for instance, how many of you actually follow the children's games scene? Yeah, so do you have kids? Yeah. Yeah, there. Define children's game? Well, anything that is targeted, for instance, for toddlers? I don't think that I need to define it. So if you're not, if you don't think that you follow any children's games. Scene. Sorry?
I thought you were from a philosophy background. Definitions are our strength.
We can have that discussion. I have a lot of arguments for that. But anyway, just a kind of an example that the games industry is so wide that none of us can actually follow the whole scene. And none of us can play very widely, like to actually include everything. We do know that, but oftentimes you also might think that you know a lot about games, and then you bump into a lot of things that you've never ever heard mentioned of. How many of you have seen these games? You have seen it?
Yes. Most of those are Soviet-era analog automat games, but it could be some retro revival that has been going a lot in the indie scene.
Can I ask you where you're from?
I am from Bulgaria.
Okay. Yeah. So Ukraine? Because these are from, these pictures are from a Moscow. Yes, if you can read it, yeah. They're from a game console museum in Moscow, which is based from the Soviet time pieces. So Ukraine would be a country that would know about this. But then the Westerners, the rest of the people in this room have never even seen a picture of this. But anyway, so there's a lot of things. Like the history of games is more or less based on the writings that we read. It's based on the writings of the Northern Americans. And I just want you to understand that this is the way that we have been taught to kind of understand game history. But there's a lot of different things in the, if you look further, or even if you look further than the digital era. Any questions on this point? Because the next thing, I'm going to talk about casual games. So this is one of the, this is also kind of a, this is an actual sentence that I've heard. So there's a people wondering in a certain time of the games business, that why would anyone play these stupid games? They're absolutely horrible. And they're referring to casual games. So casual games, I mean games like these. So Bejeweled, how many of you have played it? How many of you have heard it? Heard about it? As well. Okay. So might be game pieces that you have not heard about. I do believe that most of us have heard about, for instance, Guitar Hero. These are the kind of games that we could call casual games from different reasons. One of them being a slightly more simple, maybe the target group is wider, maybe it's easier to start playing. For instance, with Guitar Hero being a guitar, it might be easier to understand how you use it than a game controller, and so on. But saying is that as for the past 5 or more years, wait a minute, it's more like 10 years now, there's been this turn that I would call casual turn. So digital games have become kind of more popular because of the digital devices have become more kind of normal part of everyday life. There's this kind of rising peak and so on for the casual games industry. Not that popular term anymore, that we would talk about casual games in general. We do talk about social games more nowadays. But it used to be the word to use in for instance, 2008, right?
Can you give a definition for this term, casual
games? Casual games. Very popular way of defining it is that it is easy to approach game that is targeted for a wider audience than the so-called hardcore game audience. The definition is really hard on this part because not all the casual games have similar things, and then the things that we might call casual games might be actually pretty hardcore when we look at the gamers, for instance. So if we define the hardcore as a game hobby, and then we say that these are casual games, so these are not the games for the game hobbyists, we can still see a lot of hobbyists, for instance, with Bejeweled and games like that. So the game itself doesn't necessarily have to be this feature that makes them casual. But more or less, this is a phenomenon that has happened for the industry. The rising of the more simple, more accessible games, and then we call them casual games. And the word casual is there to say that it's not that you're not that devotee for the games themselves, and it has some truth in it, but it's more of a complex phenomenon. Okay. Much more questions on the casual than I expected, but there.
Do you see it there only being casual games and then hardcore games, or are there other similar segments or genres?
There, do I see that it's casual and hardcore, or are there other segments? There's a lot of different typologies that people use for making this or naming different groups of players. One of them being from the casual to hardcore, and then might be naming so that it's a casual hardcore. It's a casual core and hardcore, and then there might be casual core or core hardcore, kind of mixtures of these things. But I'm trying not to go too deep with that because I've written a couple of papers about it. That being problematic in the sense that we're not necessarily sure do we measure or do we look at the behavior of the gamers, or do we look at the demographics of the gamers, or do we look at the features of the games themselves. And this has a lot to do with the relationship between the game design and the actual play activity itself, because we can support certain kind of play activities with a game. And we might prohibit some things, but then again, there are still players behind those games. So if we design it for fleeting moments, they might use several hours for that, for instance. So it's not direct connection. And there's other typologies as well for the players. For instance, the way that they perceive the games in their life. Is it important to them or what kind of activities they want to do in the games? Like, do they play in a very aggressive style, or do they play with more of a fleeting style, or are they there for teasing other players and so on? So there's a lot of these kind of different typologies, and casual, hardcore, core can be one of those. And maybe this time of the industry, there's a lot of talk about core gamers. For instance, with this casual turn and kind of immediate after that is social games and the early social games in Facebook that was kind of more casual than what we have nowadays. Nowadays we have more core targeted games than this is kind of difficult to say because there's so much more games in general, but the talk is on the core gamers more. So I don't know if that answered at all. There was a question there, somewhere there.
Yeah, so kind of comment on who play the casual games. A good example that my cousin was being very judgmental, but I play lots of games and I'm consuming lots of time there. At the same time, I was receiving lots of like farming requests from her. to my Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
So she didn't realize she's playing a game, even though she's spending like lots of hours playing that part of the game.
Yeah. So there is an example from the gentleman in the audience that your cousin was not really, was saying that he or she didn't play games at all, and then there's a lot of requests from the Farmwell, right? Kind of simplistically like that. So that's an important notion, because one part of the whole thing is that when games have become more popular or more kind of a normal part of everyday life, you don't necessarily think of yourself as a gamer if you play a game. We don't think of think of ourselves as a hand washers, even though we would do that stuff. So for some people, games might be similar to browsing internet. So it doesn't really necessarily has anything to do with their identity. They just do it for killing time. Or then that there also might be attitudes towards on both sides of on the sides of the gamers and non-gamers. So if you're on the other side of the, if you're not on the gamer's side, you might be saying that I don't care about games at all, and then you play a lot of games. But that's, you say it because you value other stuff, like walking in the forest. And then on the other hand, the gamers might say that I don't play casual games at all, I don't care about those. And then that's the almost the whole time that you use for games. You just don't necessarily think about it too much. And then again, we might also ask, for instance, that have you played Solitaire on Windows? Like, anybody has played Solitaire on the Windows, raise your hand. Like, okay. How many of you remember exact time when you last time played Solitaire? Raise your hand. So some of the activities, we don't even remember that. And that's one of the part of the... that's difficult to study, for instance, casual gaming, if we don't have metrics, like direct metrics. It's very difficult to ask people about things on stuff that they don't remember or they don't acknowledge at all. But anyway, so casual games as a casual turn in the game industry is interesting because of that value thing. So there are different kind of things that people value in games. And discussion around the casual games somewhere in the 2007 and so reveals this valuation for certain things in games. And I've written a paper about what is different in casual games kind of design. It's slightly outdated because this goes quite fast. So for instance, the games should be acceptable. You don't want to if it's an activity that it's not your hobby, you don't want to go an extra mile to explain why you're playing Farmville, for instance, or why you're playing FPS to your grandmother. So you want to play something like Farmville that would be more understandable, that it's like a bonsai tree that I just treat. You know, think of it as a garden, which is virtual. But on the other groups of people, it might be different things. For instance, if you are with other hobbyists, other gamers, and you're playing Nintendogs or something, for instance, Farmville, you might need to explain what you're doing. Accessibility is it's a kind of a huge thing in that, so accessible in different ways, so easy to understand. For instance, guard games are easy to understand because people play them on the other fields as well, on the other domains than digital. But also accessible in a sense that there might be easy kind of instructions how you can use the game, easy controllers. It's not that challenging in the beginning and so on. So there's different things in the design. Flexibility in a sense that it has to be flexible on your time schedules, so that you don't have 8 hours, but you might have 10 minutes. And then you want to pause the game and so on. You have to do something else. You're waiting for a call, you're washing your clothes or something. And then simplicity, which goes with the other parts as well. But to remind you with the casual games,
one more question about
yes?
casual games. You mentioned that they peaked at 2008 or 9. Do you mean that they, after that, people started calling them social games? Or is Candy Crush Saga somehow different than
yes.
Bejeweled?
So the question is, I said that it peaked somewhere in the... It's kind of a 2008-ish, 9-ish, something like that. It's more or less, the term is more or less like, what did the industry talk about? For instance, GDC Game Developers Conference in San Francisco used to have casual games summit, but now it's social games, smartphone games, and so on. So this casual turn has changed the way that we think about games. For instance, if you look at the conference itself, it used to be so that, for instance, mobile things were from Monday to Wednesday, and then Monday to Tuesday, and then Wednesday to Friday, it was the AAA console things. But now it's all mixed together. So the changes has happened also in other fields of games. So the question was, do I mean that it has changed into, for instance, social games, that we talk about social games? So it's not completely the same. But social games have a trait with the casual games. And also, we do have specific conference tradition already for casual games. So Casual Connect conferences, for instance, still uses that term. But I use this picture from Google Analytics to show you that how much it was searched on Google and how it switched to people searching social games instead of casual games. So now it's more about games like Candy Crush Saga or previously Farmville and games like that, which could be thought of as casual games, but from the industry point of view, we're interested on the fact that they're on the social media platform and people play with other people. Anyway, too complicated to go with this time because I'm using a lot of time already explaining this. But I'm very happy to talk more about it. What I would like you to understand that when we talk about games, we usually do mean digital games. And we oftentimes might even mean, in some parts of the discussions, we might mean video games or console games even. But obviously this kind of normalization of digital games, because board games has been similar way, part of the everyday life for a long time already. So this has happened to digital realm now. So different kinds of people play games for different reasons. And it's not always kind of a primary reason, the game itself, but it might be instrumental value for you. So you might play some kind of a game because your friends play it, or you might play the game because you have nothing else to do, or so on, or you want to learn something or lose weight and so on. But playing itself has not changed in this way that it has become more casual. Maybe also it has become more acceptable within the decades of the history of the play in general, if we think about how sinful it was to play card games, for instance. We don't talk about that at all that much anymore. But in a sense, we should always also look at the other side of the game phenomenon, which is not digital. So, okay. Just to shortly say that looking at the things that happened with casual games trend from 2002 or 2001 was Bejeweled, perhaps. Bejeweled was released in 2001. So from that point to this day, it's interesting how the discussion revealed that there's different kinds of design values. And what we were used to before was more of like, we talked about the immersion of the game and how engaging that game was. And that might be actually bad for some of the games that people want to play. We perhaps talked about how awesome it is, how some games were very difficult and challenging and or very different and weird, and that was the good part of games. But just to show you that it's a kind of a with different values for design. And in general in design research, this is acknowledged that it's not a univalue world of design. We don't all respect, for instance, the challenge, or we don't all respect the games being flexible. But in the general world of, like, some people like tiny complex spaces in the architecture, and some people like round forms and so on. So this is something that they believe that is the kind of a distinction between the designers. So our values for that product or that environment or that thing that we're designing is affecting to the result itself. And interestingly, we don't necessarily always know what is the things that we value. And if we are talking with the kind of same-minded people, we don't necessarily see that there might be some different valuations. Anyway, I have a break coming. Okay, just to show you that if you already would say that you play widely, and then you might find out you don't play widely, you should be also interesting on the phenomena that are related to games and play, and look into the different things that could be an inspiration, an easy way for changing things. Obviously, for a creative process, they do recommend you to look widely on different kinds of things and not only like related stuff. But there might be very interesting things happening on the outskirts of digital games, and not necessarily the ones that you might follow or bump into. So I mean toys, children's play, and playful activity in general. And this is one of the things that we look in a research project that has been running for a year and a half. We're looking in the intersection of digital games and toys and the emerging of games and toys industry. And this is if you go for game industry events or lectures like this, what people talk about a lot is digital distribution, games as services, and evaluation of the immaterial things instead of material experiences. But on the toy industry side of the world, there's much more interest on hybrid experiences. How can we make toys more interesting with apps, with different kinds of digital enhancements? For instance, the new Furby has an iPad application. There is a new kind of a makeup head, which is an iPad that is pushed into this Barbie-branded makeup station. There might be cards that could be used because of the capacitive touch tags that you can insert in the card. There's different kinds of things that you can do with digital devices, like the Shifteo's play cubes. And then there's Skylanders and Infinity of Disney that is more into the game industry side. But if you go through, for instance, Gamescom, you might see a lot of equipments and then new kind of trials for people making more material productions. I will not go into details on that. And also interesting things happening on the side of the, for instance, designer toys and doll hobbies. There is this London-based startup which is making 3D printed dolls. Seen on this picture, this is my doll, and this is a picture of the avatar that you can create, which is then printed into an actual doll. And then whole kind of a culture of Blythe dolls that are photographed and then placed in a digital play realm when they are released or used in public. Also, what you could look into is train hobby and the use of miniature people in the picture play that people take amazing photographs using these traditional train hobby figures. It's a slightly different demographics for this hobby than the gamers. Anyway, yeah, I tried to rush that. I have a break, and we should continue. Okay, I promise that the rest of this lecture is kind of faster. How much time do we have?
Till half past.
Half past. Okay. So, oh, it should be fine. Yeah. So, I kind of I said that internet scratch ticket thing is the only thing that I've done, but I participated some game jams, and this is one of those games that I made on the last summer with a couple of other peoples on assembly, and we're gonna have another game jam hopefully on the next summer assembly as well. But I put it there because there's the theme of our game was love. And one thing that kind of describes game developers globally, or at least in Finland, but globally mostly, is a passion for games. That the industry is based on the passion of those games that people have played and those games that they have made, so the people are very passionate and they do 150% of work time. That's also one of the problems, because how do you keep with that? How do you make it sustainable in a sense that people are not overworking, and when you get bigger companies, how do you maintain that same passion that you are already drawing from in your production? And also, when we talk about game ideas, and from the brainstorming studies perspective, you might want to tell game developers that you should be ideating all the time. That is one of the things that are reasons for not to be that kind of full of ideas all the time, because there are certain things that might happen to game developers if they come up with a new idea. So if you're in the middle of a production and it's slightly difficult and maybe a little bit repetitive to do at the moment, you don't want to make new ideas because you would fall in love with that idea, then you would want to do that production instead of the other. So this kind of a note for how things are affecting in the game production and the everyday life of a game developer. So even though it might be better for you to be more full of ideas all the time, it might be very difficult because you do have a passion and love for those products and you would like to do all these fancy and interesting things. This is just a side note in a sense that it's an actual sentence that I had I heard in a discussion that we had with one Finnish game developer. But more often you also hear that ideas don't matter at all. It's all in the execution, it doesn't matter. You might have a great idea, but it doesn't make a great game unless you have the skills to do that. Yeah. It's also something that some experienced game developers might be very annoyed about in the young game developer wannabes, that I have this an amazing idea and I will tell it to you if you hire me, as if that would be something that they're seeking for. So everybody has a lot of ideas in the game industry, and you are not kind of interesting in that sense if you're full of ideas. But then again, I would dare to be slightly provocative on this matter, because one thing that I've been involved with is Nordic game funding, and I actually haven't seen that many good ideas presented to the Nordic game program. So it does also matter what kind of ideas you do have, because it is still starting point for your development. Just be sure that you have a lot of ideas to jump into the next one if you need to. But anyway, so that's kind of a philosophy behind ideas. What is the role of an idea? It might be something that nobody values for, and then it might be very critical for your work. And then again, also, ideas do repeat in a sense that others might have the same ideas than you have. And if you are having this great idea, somebody is already making that anyway. I did an interview study with speakers of some game conferences, and we were looking at how people do kind of talk about innovation and creativity. And we, if, even though we might think about that we share those aspects in this industry, that we are interested in making new, interesting, fabulous games that are breaking new grounds, the reality is that people have very different outtakes on how they see innovation and their work. And we found 7 different attitude profiles to kind of mark the differences. Some people might think that they're kind of for the innovation. They're spreading the message that we should together change the game industry and make new games and change the way that we see the spectrum of play and so on. And then there is this follower attitude that you might want to just follow what the others are doing and be fast and kind of tackle on the highest kind of trend things and use other games as a stepping stone. Then there are people that are more nihilistic on the innovation, either that I would like to do new stuff but I can't do in my current job, or I find it that it's stupid to do innovation for innovation's sake, or that it's not that important in at all. And then people that might say that innovation is a risky thing, so you should be aware of the risks. And then realists that might see that there are different ways to do this kind of track, that you either do the high innovation or maybe you do incremental things, and these kind of processes might help you with what you're doing. And all in all, even though artists and universalists are not the biggest profile on this research, the message, underlining message is that some people might find that games in themselves are innovative already, so everything that you do is innovation, or that it's important for yourself to be innovative, to make new stuff, to contribute to the game industry. But it's still personal for many people, in a sense that they are passionate on the, what they do and what kind of new stuff is that they are working on, that how other, for instance, peers are seeing their work and so on. I said it already. So I believe everything that I do has to do with innovation is kind of descriptive of what some people might think that the games are about. So you are within the game industry because it's new and interesting and new stuff happen and it's going kind of dynamically into new directions. But one thing is that if we talk about execution itself, we have a great idea, but then it has to be done, and what kind of process would ensure that this new thing is becoming live. So we made a study of Finnish game companies and their developers from different levels, from hands-on to CEOs, and we did ask them to describe their process and draw a picture how it's done. And the pictures were quite different, even within the game companies themselves. That is one interesting thing, and I already said that you might have very specific language within game industry, and it changes from a company to another, and also from an individual to another. And this is all due to the fact that we don't have a formal education that has been gone on for decades. We don't call the same things as mock-ups, for instance. That some people might mean different thing with that than the other people. And some companies might have a specific words that they use for the same things that on the other companies. But anyway, so the language differs, and when they're describing the process, it looks different, but it also, they use different words, even though they're doing the same process together. But some things we found on those pictures that were coming kind of, how do you say, like repeating patterns in the sense that what kind of things are put into those pictures. So for instance, a lot of people used word designer because it is pivotal for the process. Some had an idea word in the pictures, and then there's a lot of iteration arrows and so on. I have on the next slide, I have a picture of one of those pictures that they made. But all in all, even though there's a lot of study on the user kind of studies and maybe even talk about how to include users in the game design process, this was done on 2009, the collection of the data, so we've moved on a little bit. The pictures are already different. But there's people, meaning that the people that make the games are part of the process and being very important part of how you manage the development. Then ideas themselves are critical. And also evaluation points. So when you are putting, like trashing the ideas, which ideas do you select and when? And then iteration itself. And I'm going to show you, what kind of picture was one of the examples. So these kind of pictures the developers made. The other picture is from a book by Tracy Fullerton, a game design workshop. If I remember correctly, it's from 2004, maybe. And it's kind of an ideal way of understanding how game development goes with the cycle, with the iteration phase into the finalization and the launch, and then your design is ready. The pictures that we had people made are much more messy. So this is also one point. When you're reading books about the game development process, it doesn't tell you how it actually is happening. It tells you more or less how this particular person is thinking that it should happen, or the successful processes were like this. But anyway, so yeah, there.
As a researcher, very surprised that the answers to these questions they are so evenly distributed.
Yeah, that was interesting because this is like we did the. Yeah, okay, so this is the average of all the people that what kind of things that they included in their picture. So we did a content analysis of what kind of words and what kind of stuff that they were talking about. But then the individual pictures of people, they are a lot different. So some might have more human management on their creative process picture of the game development. Some people might have a lot of evaluation points. And so on. I unfortunately didn't include the picture that had the ties of all the interviewees. But anyway, so these are the things that came up. And also, this picture shows that how kind of simplistic it is. It's not too fancy the way that game kind of the development process is proceeding and what kind of things happen in there. Because the other stuff that we had didn't have any kind of specific shared box for things. So these were just the way that you would feel it in the, like, just to start your own game company, and this is the organic practice that you would do. And after a couple of development rounds, you might have the similar picture. So, yeah, maybe they could be like nowadays if we would have, maybe there would be a lot of mentions of metrics or tools used for tracking users and so on. That's also telling a story about how productions change through time in the sense that what is important is what are you actually making, what kind of product you're making, and not every game production is the same. So people were also discussing about obviously how a sequel of a game is a different kind of process than a new experimental genre-breaking game or so on. But anyway, if you read the books, they have a very kind of vague idea of the whole reality of game making. But iteration is something which is pivotal and it's emphasized a lot in game production. How many of you have Okay, let's ask this. How many of you have heard the word iteration in game production? Okay, because I had to check, so it's not always like that. But anyway, so this is a slogan. This is like the one important thing, and that's also what game jams are based on, the iterative nature. You do one slice of the game or what kind of one prototype, and then you see, you can feel the game, you can try it, you can test it, and you see how it works on the next one. But this is where the process is based on. So if something doesn't work, you just try to find another way to do it. But what interests me in this current moment, I'm in the middle of collecting data, more data for the exact iteration, because people do seem to have different opinions how it works. Most of the game developers would definitely agree on the fact that you need to iterate. That's the point. You can't know with the first try that it maybe that might happen, but it is very much based on you trying and then trying again and making it work. But when there is more iteration and when there is less iteration, what do you need to iterate? Who iterates? And so on. These are not shared things. So people might have even strong opinions on it should be more for the pre-production side, or there should be more room for iteration in the production itself, or even in the last meters of the game development. People might have very different views on that. And last year, GDC conference had an interesting presentation. This was my highlight of the conference. It's a Star Fox designer's view on or take out on the design process, and he didn't use at all word iteration, but obviously he was talking about that. He was talking about design occlusion or creative occlusions in a way that if you are having a game that, for instance, is basing on shooting mechanics, that you have a gun in your game. He's saying that maybe you should just take it away. Maybe that's the best part in your mind that you would have in the game. You just take it away, and you pretend that it's not going to come back at all, or maybe it will not come back at all. And you're trying to work with the game without the gun. And what would make it interesting without shooting? And then you might find different things, maybe that there might be a mechanic of digging or some kind of environmental dynamics or something. And if you put the gun back in the game, it's more deep in the design sense. And I found this very interesting because this is a very specific way of understanding or kind of specific method for iteration, that you purposefully take something away and then you work on the game on the other aspects and then you return it or not. And that might be slightly difficult for a lot, if we go back with the thoughts of the passion, that if you're very, very passionate and you have been thinking about this certain idea for 10 years, and it's very important that there is a gun in this game because you love this shooting mechanics that you came up with and it's awesome, but the game is not interesting at all in total. So it might be very difficult to let go, but that's a lot of the part of the process is to methodologically just seek for another solutions. Yeah?
Yeah, partly related to that. Have you seen in your research when do these companies stop iterating and just scrap the project and start a new one from scratch?
So when companies stop the production and just trash the game and start a new one?
Yeah, rather than continue to iterate on something that they can't get to work.
Rather than sorry, this is so stupid to repeat it, but yeah. Anyway, so you were asking that: have I seen it, or is there a point in the production that they would skip the whole thing?
Yeah,
right.
Does it come up?
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about. I've had a lot of discussions how people might do all together a full production, and then there's reasons that they just cancel it. That's kind of sad part of the game industry, but it happens a lot. But then again, there are views of the people that sometimes it's better to just stop doing it because it doesn't work at all, and then we just do something else. But people might differ with the views on that. So I think that some of the fights within the game companies might be for that. Do we continue with this crappy thing because this other person is thinking that it will be better? We just iterate, and so on. And some people might have experiences that at one point they did win the challenge, so they came up with something that salvaged the whole production. But then some people might have the experience that it usually never happens, so we should just quit now. But altogether, I don't think that there is specific studies that would give you an average point or even a guideline when you should give up. It's very much of an organic practice. You just have to decide. And usually it is that you're running out of money. You just have to quit. Or you get an actual job, so you can't continue with that, or something like that. But we don't know the differences. It's a slogan. It's a very kind of basis of game development, but we do have differences between developers. We don't know what those are. So that's one of my tasks, to find out a little bit more about what are the differences in thinking of, in terms of how iterative game design process is working, and what would be the best options or not, in opinion of the, what people think it's best or not, what is worse. And one of the sentences that people might say, and it's also in my data, this is very expensive to do iteration, even though a lot of people value that. It is so expensive that you might give up on doing iteration. A couple of words about Game Jam, which is an intense 48-hour game challenge, or game production challenge. We do have participation in Finland to the Global Game Jam also this year, and we have 14 different locations, which you could even still register to. Helsinki is completely full, but other sites might have room. But I do believe that there is some kind of connections. It's a different thing to do 48 hours challenge with people that you might even not know, and on the team that was just given by someone else, and so on. But this practice of game jams and the high popularity for the past years for different kinds of game jams is telling a kind of story for rapid prototyping kind of thinking, and maybe the emphasis on the iteration. So you're making one production and see how it works. You are limiting the time and you have to get it ready instead of just pre-planning a lot and then using your resources into something that will never work. One argument for game jams is that we usually, when we think about Finnish game industry, what we say, where did it start from, is that what two kind of explanations or two factors in it is demo scene and assembly as a kind of cultural tradition. But I do dare to say that the future history of game developers is in the jamming scene. So a lot of new companies start from these communities, and new products are starting to emerge from different kinds of game jams. There's a huge amount of different ways to participate, or different kinds of global activities. And also to look into this is that it is truly global. We have people from Egypt, Japan, Syria, Sweden, Finland, American, Northern, Southern American countries. So everywhere around the globe. It's also telling this story about how making games can happen. So success stories can rise from cultures that we didn't know that are making games or interested in digital play at all. So I'm really looking forward to first African success stories and so on. Obviously, there's a lot of games that we might already play. We don't know where they were made, but it's interesting scene in itself. what we're doing in the Finnish Game Jam is that we're trying to also support people exploring new things. And I highlighted these four games that were interesting in my in my own perspective. They're also highlighted in the last year's jam. Even though they might be very simple, not too fancy, there's always some kind of interesting thing in these games. And that's one thing that you might want to explore with this limited time exploration kind of challenges. Not necessarily doing the amazing thing and the idea that you've been cultivating for 10 years. But to do something simple, one thing that might be interesting. For instance, this game here with the old man just walking. It's like the game experience itself is not that interesting because you're just pressing buttons. But the story itself, that there is an old man who tries to walk as slow as possible to the top of the mountain. It's kind of a slow food of games that we're used to different kinds of experiences. But anyway, so kind of to highlight that game jams could be the source for new ways of thinking games, and that's what we need, kind of want to also support. And I hope that you will be one of those that would make interesting new experiences. You might also, you could do also hybrid things, as we did on this one game jam. We did this plush toy that was equipped with an iPhone. I'm going to skip this to make it easier for you. This is a quote from Kåpe Hiltunen, head of NeoGames in Finland. And he said in one student seminar that the only difference between students and experts on that panel that was going on was that they have failed more. And as I said previously, or said many times during this lecture already, that you might want to search for your own information and not to kind of rely on the lectures or books or writings, is that you have to be the one that makes that information in order to succeed in games business, which is pretty volatile. It's changing all the time. So when somebody is telling you something that's already kind of old news, you might be able to utilize that, or you might be already too late. And those people don't know that. Nobody knows what's going to happen next. You can be the one that makes the next move. You can be the one that makes the next step. And that's also kind of the amazing part of the game industry right now, is that you are empowered to be the next people. You're not the followers, and you're not necessarily the ones that will be just working here, but you can be the ones that changes what happens. Or even though you're learning maybe free-to-play models and so on, try to think of that as, okay, this is what they know now. What is that they are working on this moment that they will not tell you, perhaps, or that they can't explain or explicate, or what is the next step? What is going to happen next? Because that is probably the information that you need more than the one that they're telling you on this lecture series. So that would be my last note on the lecture, and maybe the most important thing that I want to say, that please do learn yourself instead of sitting on the lecture. Thank you.